this quote out here, the center of the right lane. Like I said, we're going to think about that. The center of the right lane. That's where you want to be, in the center of the right lane. So think about that. Hopefully we'll get to that. Okay? We're going to start at the top here, and I did give you this letter of Yad Nicus, Nifus, 2nd century. Joe got it for me. You'll read that. It's very, very interesting. We just got through the persecuted church. That would have been written during that time, especially the first one. They're trying to describe the manner of Christians and their relationship to the world. And it's just amazing. As the world looked on, Pliny's letter and some of these others, it was like, we have to persecute them because the emperor told us, but watch how they love each other, how they care for people, and they never strike back in the, you know, all the things that the Bible says. So they have a great testimony in their world. Now we get to the state church. Sometimes it's called the post-Nicene age, since it comes after the Council of Nicaea. So in some churches, in some books, it's the state church. Sometimes it's called the post-Nicene age. The sequence, that's the last part of the ancient church from Pentecost to the popes. And so you fill them in from Pentecost to Patmos, which is the first part of this subset. Then the persecuted churches from Patmos, 100 where John's on the island, to popularity. We just ended that. And that's called the persecuted church. And now they become popular. And then finally, this is the state church from popularity to a pope, Gregory the Great. So let's think about the conditions. The church became the state religion. A little bit of a history here, the new status. From illegal to obviously legal or religia, illicita to illicita. So the huge status change for the church at this time. Let's just give a couple dates in here. A little bit of controversy on a few of the dates. But basically, here's how it goes. Diocletian tried to eliminate the church in 300. And that was a great persecution, remember, because every persecution got worse because the church kept growing, so they just got worse and worse. And so he finally said, we're going to eliminate it. We're going to kill off every Christian available, so there is no church. That'll be the end of it. We can't live with it. Obviously, it did not work. The empire, the Roman Empire, not only had to deal with the enemies around them, but now they had these Christians in the middle of them that were just driving these emperors crazy. So what he did was he started to divide the empire into the east and the west. And so things like that are starting to develop. Many of these things develop over time. The East became known as the Greeks. The West, of course, became known as the Latins. In 306, Constantine became a co-emperor. And when he came on the scene, they were still persecuting the church. But by 311, there came the Edict of Toleration. Galerius, Constantine, Licinius are all names associated with that. And we studied that last week, where we will tolerate Christianity. All people are free to believe and practice their religious beliefs with freedom, toleration. It was the initial policies of Licinius and Constantine. In 312, you have that historical event where Constantine, has to defeat Maxentius, or he has to meet him, at the bridge, or battle of the Milvian Bridge. In history, it is said, if you read Kuyper and some of the others, that there he saw the image of the cross, and it said, go forth and conquer. Not every historian will say he really believes that actually happened. But anyway, you will read that every history book you ever read, you'll read something about that. But at that point, he did win the battle. And it's generally noted, in a general sense, that at that point, he said, I become a Christian. You can't beat him, so we're going to join him. We've tried and tried and tried, and you can't kill these guys, so we're going to join him. 313, they issued the Edict of Milan. Him and Licinius were co-emperors at that time, which gave even greater protection and rights of the Christians. Somewhere in there, he declares himself to be a Christian. In 324, somewhere in there, he becomes the sole emperor. Between 313 and 324, Constantine and Licinius come to Athens because Licinius wants to go back. He said, we're going to tolerate the Christians, and then somewhere after that he says, we're not, we're going to wipe them out again. And Constantine says, no, we've made this decision, and I'm a Christian, so him and Licinius kind of had to go at it. And as a result of that, he became the sole emperor in 324, and there he decreed. Yeah, Joe?
Do you think that Constantine was actually a Christian?
I don't know. Some days I do, and some days I don't. I know this. And it's true of all history. This is a good point. As you read people in history, we're going to read about Arius today, Leo the First. There'll be parts of them you say, how in the world could that possibly be a Christian? Even Luther. He threw out the book of James, the book of the ego. How could he possibly be a Christian? You know? And then there'll be other parts of what they do, and you go, that's right on. And what maybe it teaches us, if somebody 300 years writes about Richmond Hukum, you're going to say, how in the world could he do that? No. But I was doing what I thought was right, and hopefully to some extent I am right, but might be a little cautious about thinking you have it all down right, because Luther did too, and so did Calvin, and so did Constantine. There were parts of him, Constantine, that you say, I think he really became a Christian. And other things you go, no, Christians don't do that. So I don't know. That's my answer. I don't know. There's a lot of debate. But anyway, he decrees. There's a little debate on if he decreed it or not. But Christianity is decreed, most people would say, as a state religion. However, there is a turn back. Julian the Apostate, 361 to 363, decides to be a non-Christian emperor. He becomes the last non-Christian emperor. He attempts to revive or restore what he calls, in history is written, the traditional Roman religious practices. So you can see there's always transition. It's never boom, boom, all right? So there's an attempt to wipe it up, then they let off, then they try to bring it back, then they let off, and whatever. So Julian the Apostate, in 361 to 363, tries to wipe it out again. However, he's not successful. He only lasts 2 years there. In 380 to 395, Theodosius the First, or Theodosius the Great, makes it for a final decree. It makes it the official and the exclusive religion of Rome. And so from this point on, it's going to be official. However, it's interesting to know that Rome, Western Rome, fell to the Goths less than 100 years from then, 476. But while that's happening, all the tribes and so to the north, many of them are becoming Christian, in name at least, in the general sense. So 496, Clovis, the king of the Franks, professed Christianity. We're going to find Ireland became a Christian land, and Britain, and whatever. Okay? But anyway, the main point is Christianity has a whole new status. They went from persecuted to popular. And that would be great, right? If only Christianity was the most popular religion in America, and all of our political leaders were Christians, and we got special status on our income tax for being Christians, and you know, we got all the prime jobs, the ambassadors, and everything. Wouldn't that be great? All privileges, all possessions, and all power went to us Christians. It'd be a wonderful world. We'd be in heaven. Well, that happened once in history, at least in a broad sense. And the answer to that, of course, is if we were all genuine Christians, it would be a great place. If we're Christians in name, it doesn't work. They not only had a new status, they had a new capital. They moved the capital from Rome to Byzantium, B-Y-Z-A-N-T-I-U-M, on the Bosphorus. If you remember where that is where Europe and Asia meet. It's today the city of Istanbul. It became known as Constantinople. It was done under the leadership of Constantine, and therefore they named it Constantinople. Or sometimes it was called the New Rome. It was in the year 324, 325, and there, not long after the Edict of Milan and some of those things, he is moving everything. There are some reasons for it. It provided natural protection. And Rome, as you see, is starting to be attacked from outside as well. The Goths and the Franks and the others are up there, and even south in Africa. So Rome was militarily vulnerable. And they understood it. So the move to Istanbul, Constantinople, was a good move because in as many ways as I understand it in history, that city has never really been militarily conquered. And so politically it was a good move. As a state, it was a good move. But also, it was a good move religiously. Because, as it says here, it was away from the heathen influences of Rome. Rome and the city of Rome was greatly influenced by heathenism. To go to the east, there were more Christians in the East. The first church started in the East. So that was a much safer place for his religious conviction. So as a state and as a religious conviction, it was a better spot. So they have a new capital, Constantinople. Now, 324, generally given, 325 maybe. There were new, like I say, most of these things happen over time. You know, you just don't move capital in one day. All right? There were new churches. And you have a picture of Santa Sofia. Hopefully you can see pictures of that, which was the largest in Constantinople. You can't believe it to this day. And suddenly now the church, which was kind of underground, becomes the church that can build buildings. So they start to build buildings. And then, you know, now it becomes who can build the biggest building. And if you're the capital, you got to build the biggest. You know, so the Xerxes, you have the biggest, all right? In 600 AD, that one was burnt. It had a fire. They rebuilt it. And in 1453, the Turks took over the whole region. And eventually, at that point at least, made it into a mosque. And if you go to Istanbul today, I've never been there, but you would still go to that. It's a blue mosque. Huge. And it was the old church, Sophia.
What was that?
Pardon me?
What's the name of it?
Sophia. Fill in the blank, Sophia. There are also new challenges. The Bishop of Constantinople suddenly became a rival of the Bishop of Rome. We're going to see tonight how the Bishop of Rome wanted power, and the Bishop of Constantinople wanted power. Who's the biggest church? Who's the real head of it? Would the capital politically moved, would not the religious capital move? Okay? So the Bishop of Constantinople was called the Patriarch. To this day, Greek Orthodox has patriarchs, you know. Whereas the Bishop of Rome is called the, what is it, Joyce?
Papa.
All right. The Pope. And to this day, the Western Church has a Pope. The Western and the Eastern Church, therefore, became rivals in the initial sense. And we're going to find in 1054, they finally split, and it's split ever since. Okay? So those are some of the conditions that have changed in that period of the state church from 325 to 590. Now, while that was going on, some other things happened. You will quickly read, and as you read through the history books, about the corruptions that took place. The church is no longer persecuted, but it's popular. And because the church was now part of the culture and not distinct, what's the word for distinct in the Bible?
Holy.
It's no longer distinct. You know, everybody's a Christian. Because we're a Christian nation, you know. Because it's now a part of the culture and not holy or distinct. Two extremes developed, and one is reaction to the other. One is syncretism. And that means to mix together. So the church begins to mix with the world. They're a part of the culture. And with the state. It was hard to distinguish the church from the state. It was hard to distinguish if the Pope was the most important or the patriarch or the emperor, whoever was in charge. So they're starting to mix. The other part of it, the church gained privilege, a privileged status. It gained greater power of the empire. I mean, popes and patriarchs and bishops never told the emperor what to do before, and now they're starting to have great influence and great power. They gained great possessions, so that by the time of Hilary, who may have been one of the reformer popes, he said this, with the gold of the state, you burden the sanctuary of God, which is to say, the sanctuaries, the buildings were getting so filled with gold and ornate stuff, he said, we can't worship God anymore. We just walk in and like, whoa, look at that glass, look at that gold, look at that, you know, you're not worshiping God anymore. It was terrible. Ultimately, the world became worldly, or the church became worldly. And so syncretism. If you have ever been or lived in a country that had a religious system, and another group came in, conquered it, and made it a new religion, you would see that exactly. If you go to Bolivia, for example, the Spanish came in, conquered it, made them all Catholics. They're all Catholics. They were all Inca Indians before that, you know, or the Amaru Indians. See, all their practices. So guess what happened? When you make them all Christians, boom, today we're all getting baptized, let's go down to the river, you're all in, we're all suddenly Christian. You have a way of thinking that hasn't been erased, and you have a way of living that has not been erased. And immediately, when you make them all Christians at once, you're going to get a syncretism, a mixture. So if you go to Bolivia today, it's a Catholicism that is so different than anything you've ever known, you think, this cannot be Catholics. For example, in the street markets, you have the fetuses, the dried fetuses of llamas. And you have to, in every building, the footing has to have dried fetuses of llamas in it. Now tell me where in the Catholic tradition that's taught. That's not a Catholic tradition. And so the Roman Catholic Church has been very good at that. Wherever you go, they have mixed whatever religion was already there with what they brought in. The Muslims are masters of it. They do not bring pure Muslim anywhere. All right? You go to the Muslim North Africa, they allow the North Africans who are animists to be animists. Well, they call them Muslims. So the Muslim in the Gambia, for example, is totally different than a pure Muslim. Okay? So anytime you make a whole land of people of Christianity or Muslim or whatever, you're going to syncretize them. So that was one side. So the church became worldly, became powerful, became great in so many different ways. As a result of that, there was another extreme that came along, and that's called separation. Now, we all understand we are supposed to be separate from the world, so that's not a bad word, separatism. But it's a reaction here against the worldliness in the church. Some things came along here. Monasticism, from the word mono, which means alone. So monasteries started showing up in a reaction to how secular, evil, rotten, worldly the church was. Some of the guys said, and the ladies said, I can't be a part of it. So in, for example, in 340 AD in Egypt, on a river, an island in the river Nile, they built the first monastery. And they said, we just got to pull it apart. We got to go alone. And so monasteries started it. Asceticism. You know, that means to live a frugal life, to deprive yourself of things. If you like chocolate, I'm going to be an ascetic. I won't eat chocolate. All right? If you like gold, I won't have gold, whatever it is. So asceticism came because they saw the abuse of it, they threw it out. Celibacy, to refrain from marriage and physical union. Hermits started coming. Many saints were hermits. They would retire, which means to retire from the world. I'm just going to be a hermit, live alone. There are some famous ones, by the way, if you study church history. It's just the guy who sat on the pole for how many years was it, you know, in North Africa. He just sat on the top, he lived on the top of the pole for like 40 years or whatever it was. There were cloisters. By the way, that became a show. He was a hermit on top of the pole and everybody came to see him. You know, how long did this guy sit on top of the pole? He did 30 years. Cloisters were where they grouped together. So you want to separate from the world, I want to separate from the world, we'll join together, usually in a monastery. So we're on the same page. And because of that, they started orders. An order is the various cloisters. We might have a cloister here, a monastery here, you might have one over there. And we realize, hey, we're on the same page. So let's be a part of the order of the Benedictines, or the Augustinians, or the Franciscans, or whatever. The first one were the Benedictines in 529. So all those things start because of that. So on one side you got syncretism, on the other side you got separation going on. One is saying we're just like the world, the other says we're getting out of here, we can't handle it, too much power, too much possession. The separation, there's some good to it. As you read about it, many times you identify with these guys and say, yeah, I think I might have been in that monastery. I think I might have joined them, you know. It was against worldliness. They did promote the study of the Bible. Unfortunately, the monasteries we know of, which are years and hundreds of years later, their study of the Bible, if you've ever been to those monasteries or any monasteries anywhere, you know, from 4 a.m. to whatever, they read the Bible. And if you go there, they're all going, and they haven't taken a bath in 3 weeks, and it's just terrible. You know, it's just a really bad thing. And that's their study of the Bible. But originally, they really did study the Bible. Martin Luther was one of those, right? He really studied the Bible, all right? He got away from the world, because the world was corrupt. He got away from the church in the world, and he went to a monastery, and there he really studied the Bible. So there was some good that came out of it. They promoted the copying of scriptures. That's one thing. You can do copy the scriptures. That's before they had the printing press. So, there's a book by Thomas Cahill entitled How the Irish Saved Civilization. I think I gave it to one of you because I can't find it on my shelf. So if you have it, give it back to me. His whole point is the Irish, who became Christians and developed a lot of monasteries, and you can go, they're called the Celtic books. They copied the scriptures in the dark ages of the European history. When everything was bad, the Irish monasteries kept copying the scriptures, and if they had not done that, Western civilization may have lost much of the scriptures. They just did it. Thousands and thousands of copies. And whether they were Christian or not, irrelevant. They saved the scriptures in many ways, how the Irish saved civilization. Yet returned to frugal living. Instead of extravagance, they were more frugal and whatever. It provided care for the needy. They really did care for people, and if you were hungry or whatever, you could go to a monastery or an abbey or whatever and get some meat. So there was some good to it. St. Francis of Assisi and many of them, Martin Luther, many of them went to some of these monasteries, and you could probably find some good in it. There are some bad to it, however. It did remove the sloth of the earth. Some of the best men and women that God had were taken out of influencing society. They lived in some monastery in the middle of nowhere. It did foster spiritual pride. If anything you do can foster pride, if you're not careful. So it's easy to think of yourself, I'm a little more spiritual than because I don't, whatever, you know. We have some people living not too far from you who can foster spiritual pride by being humble, all right? And not having cars or whatever it is. You can quickly degenerate into pride. And finally, it promoted works as merit. And out of the whole monastery cloister movement, there came a strong emphasis upon works. And after a while, that became works as a merit. God is pleased with that, so that's what you ought to do, either for salvation or for Him. I'd just like to read 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1, 2, and 3. The Spirit expressly says that in the latter times, some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons, forbidding to marry, and commanding to abstain from food. There are two doctrines of demons that God truly hates: celibacy and asceticism. And that's exactly what was starting to happen in that period of time. So, there was corruption. And it ended up being two ways. So why do we have this quote here? The center of the right lane. Well, it's a play on the word right, okay? You should be in the right lane of life. Not the right to the, in comparison left, the right in comparison to the wrong. And stay in the center of it. Okay? Spurgeon said it this way. Often we think of truth as like this. Okay, here's a mountain, a little road on it, and you're walking along on this road, and you're afraid of falling off the edge. So you, what do? You go as close as you can to the inside, right? Now often we think that, you know, here's a doctrine. If I'm not careful, I'm going to go into error. So I'm going to back up over here, right? Spurgeon said, the reality is truth is a narrow precipice from which you can fall either to the left or to the right. And I think you find that again and again in history, you find that in life. Many of these, because somebody went right and it's wrong, I'm going to protect myself and react to that, so I'm going left. And when I go left, I fall off the other side. And monasteries and some of those things started probably with good motives. They wanted to be pure, right, all those kinds of things. And they ended up just as bad, only on the other side of the coin. And we have to ask this question, how do we react to error? Be really careful about overreacting to error. Because somebody goes right, be careful you don't go left. Okay? It can happen in any area of your life. And you could name it, you could discuss it, but it would be true. So there was corruption, but it ended up being on both ends. And probably if you and I were there, we'd probably like the monastery guys at least initially more than the other guys, but there were some great men on the other side too. Okay. Now the controversies. When you think of this period, generally you're going to spend a lot of time on the controversies and the councils. We're going to primarily just think about three of them. We're going to talk a little bit more about the other three and then give you some notes about it. First of them is called the Arian controversy, which led to the Council of Nicaea, which happened in 325 AD. The issue was, is the Son, namely Jesus Christ, is the Son fully God as the Father is fully God? Now, Arius was a presbyter, an elder of the Alexandrian church, and he came to this conclusion, the Son was created and therefore was different in essence from God the Father. So his way of looking at Jesus Christ was this. Here is God, and God created the Son, who is Jesus Christ, and Jesus Christ created all things material and immaterial, angels, whatever, the world and all that. So Jesus Christ is the creator of all that we know. But Jesus Christ himself was created by God and therefore is different in essence than God. Okay? As the highest creator, as the creator of all this stuff, the created who became a creator, he is still to be worshipped. before you throw Arius completely out, in many other areas, you would totally agree with Arius. He was a great guy. He was a great preacher. He was very influential, as we will see. But in this one, he's trying to do it. Why did he come up with that? Well, the line here, to make Christ equal with God, he said, if we say to the people that God and Christ are equal in essence, they will charge us with polytheism. And we are not polytheists. We are monotheists. And so in an attempt to stay away from polytheism or be accused of that, he comes up with this. It's called the Arian controversy. In response to that, a young deacon in his church by the name of Athanasius, who later became a presbyter of Alexandria Church, who he's a lot younger, no match. You ever take on an older man? I did that once. I was a deacon. I sat in a deacon's meeting. I was like 24. And anyway, don't ever do that. You are no match. Even if you're right, I was dead right. But in the day, my pastor killed me. I walked out of there very humble. But to this day, I know I was dead right. He was dead wrong. He did not believe in inspiration, and I did. And I could prove it. And he just made me look like an idiot. Athanasius took on his pastor, all right? He was older and wiser. Athanasius was right, though. He said the Son is eternal and therefore is identical in essence to the Father, in essence. So the Father and the Son are the same in substance, but they're distinct in person. They are two persons. They're not the same person. You understand why this is an issue? Because it's hard to understand how it's an issue of the Trinity, right? How can we have one God with three persons, you know? Just, there's a part of that that your mind can't quite get around. And so Arius and Athanasius, Eusebius, the bishop of Caesarea, Palestine, tried to come in and tried to be the neutral figure. So he said the Son was not a created being. Right? That's good. But he also said he is also not the same in essence. But he has a likeness or a similarity of essence to the Father. So, what do you do? Well, this is splitting the church. The church is now the state religion, so it's splitting the empire. Constantine, for political and religious reasons, has to deal with it. And he does. So he calls the Council of Nicaea. He calls it. It's in Constantinople. I'm sorry, Nicaea is near Constantinople. It's 325. He calls 318 bishops. It's interesting. Eight of them are from the west, and 310 are from the east. So it might be a little stacked on one side. The east was the stronger church originally. You know that. The west was the weaker church. The results. The creed of Arius was decisively rejected. Arius is wrong. Out the door. The creed of Eusebius was initially rejected, but it was then modified and adopted. What he had written was eventually adopted, from what I understand, with the insistence on the identity of essence. So they ended up with Jesus Christ is not created, and he is not different in essence. He is the same essence as God. He is fully God, in other words. Okay, so that was the Arian controversy. The importance of this. Well, it is considered the first ecumenical or general council. Acts 15 would be a provincial council, a local council. This is the first where the whole church came together. Many, if you read any church history book, I'll tell you that. It developed a clear picture or doctrine of the deity of Christ, and it provided a basis for agreement and unity among the churches. And they wrote what is called the Nicene Creed, which is one of the great creeds of all time. You can see there are three paragraphs, one on the Father, one on the Son, and one on the Holy Spirit. Doesn't take much to describe the Father. It takes a lot to describe the Son, and doesn't take quite as much to describe the Holy Spirit. The lines that you would probably want to highlight are the ones that are highlighted for your underline. He is very God of very God. They're trying to make it clear Jesus Christ is identical in essence with God the Father. He is fully God. We cannot deny that. He is very God of very God. He is begotten, because as the Bible says, but he is not created. He is co-substantial, being of one substance with the Father. So they are trying, you can read the rest of it. So they're trying to, and I think they got it right. They got it right. So there's the first council. The Arian controversy, Council of Nicaea, 325. The second controversy is the Apollinarian controversy, which led to the Council of Constantinople in 381. Here the issue is the relationship between the divine and the human sides of Christ. Divine and human. All right? Is Jesus Christ God or is he man? To what extent is he God? To what extent is he man? And you can again understand this is like, how can he be God, fully God, and fully man? Somehow our mind has a hard time getting around it, and throughout history there's been a huge controversy. And so, Apollinarius, the bishop of Laodicea in Syria, thought he had the solution. He said, Christ had a human body and soul, but the divine Logos took the place of the human spirit. So obviously he was a trichotomous, body, soul, and spirit. So the body and soul were human, the spirit was divine. And that's how he explained it. Now, you quickly read that, you realize he used the word logos, which, of course, is used in John chapter 1 of the Lord Jesus Christ. But he's using it differently. He's using like the Greek philosophers would use it. Okay? So he's bought into some Greek philosophy, and many of these guys had. And he's saying the divine logos took over the human spirit, or took over or replaced the spirit of Jesus. In other words, Jesus was not fully man, like your man. Neither was he fully God. He was somewhere in between, in that mixture. The Council of Constantinople in 381 condemned Apollinarius and declared that Jesus Christ was full humanity and full deity. He is fully God and he is fully man. And if your mind can't understand that, you're not the first person, but you still can believe it to be true. Just like the Trinity. I can't fully explain it, but I can believe it, and I know it's true. Okay? We're going to see another statement later on. The third controversy we like to study is, so the first one has to do with like the Trinity, the second one has to do with the deity, humanity of Jesus, the person of Jesus Christ. The third one is called the Pelagian controversy, which led to the Council of Ephesus in 431 A.D. The issue is the nature of man, sin, and salvation. It's a very short summary of it, probably not even adequately explained at all, but in some ways it's the nature of man's sin, why is man sin, and of man's salvation. How do you get saved, and can you keep it? Okay? You're going to see that this is very strangely familiar to what we call Calvinism versus Arminianism. All right? So this is not new with John Calvin. Pelagius was born in Britain or Ireland in the 4th century. He was a man of impeccable character, they say, blameless, you know, as the scripture talks about. So he was a great man. Anybody here born and raised and you really were a pretty good person? Some of us were, weren't we? Yeah. We all know now we were sinners, but I mean, you're 10 years old. I was a pretty good kid. I didn't do a lot of things a lot of people do. I don't think I ever stole. I really don't think I ever stole anything in my whole life. I mean, I was just a good kid. So what happens to people who are good kids? I conclude what? I'm basically good. Right? And I really don't need salvation because I'm alive and well. You know? Not until God convicted me and made me see how terrible I was. That happened. So that's what was true of Pelagius. He went to Rome in 400 and on to Africa. And he said this, man is by birth and nature alive and well. He's alive and well versus later on we're going to be dead in your trespasses and sin. That is to say, man sins by imitation of Adam's sin. So the reason I sinned, the only reason I sinned was because I saw you sin. I would have never thought of lying until I saw you guys lying. And I would have never thought of stealing until I saw you guys steal. And I never would have lost my temper until I saw you lose your temper. I mean, I was a good kid. So the only reason you sin is because you are imitating your environment. But you personally, inherently, are alive in Christ and well. Man has complete free choice because man is capable of that. You're a good person. You will choose the right thing every time, or most of you will. And therefore, man can lose his salvation if he chooses. In that time, a man by the name of Augustine comes along, born in Numidia, 354. He was converted in Milan under Ambrose in 386. He became the bishop of Hippo in 395. When he heard of Pelagius, he just came unglued. He said, no, man is by birth and nature dead in his trespasses and sin. Man sins because he is a sinner. You watch a kid 2 years old or 2 weeks old, you don't have to teach them anything about saying no. You don't have to teach them anything about lying or stealing or whatever. They somehow figure that all out, all right? And therefore, divine grace is what is crucial if you're ever going to be converted and overcome man's resistance. And once that happens, if God saves you, you are eternally secure. In between that was semi-Pelagian view, man is by birth and nature sick. So you have alive and well, dead in your trespasses and sin, or I'm sick, I'm in need, but you know, there's still a little spark of goodness in me. You know, I think I maybe get the right food, I can pull myself out of this. Alright? Joe?
I was going to say, I read a book about Augustine a while ago,
yeah,
a couple years ago, and when they debated, they were like fierce about it back then.
You were right.
I was really surprised at how fierce they were about it. And he wrote a bunch of books and like filled like the...
And then it was heresy versus truth. It's not a, like, well, okay, well, I'll go home tonight. And you believe you're dead in trespasses, and I believe I'm alive and well, so it doesn't matter. Well, I'll just go home. Well, to them, it was like the difference between heaven and hell. My theology in this issue makes all the difference in the world. So what happened? Council of Ephesus in 431, that neither Augustine's nor Pelagius' view were accepted. However, Pelagian's view was condemned, along with Nestorianism. The semi-Pelagian view was eventually condemned by the Council of Orange in 529 AD. So that was a great controversy. There is a sheet here, which hopefully you have, if you really want to study it. It is really virtually identical to the common one. Calvinist, Arminian. Well, I'm not a 5-point Calvinist, I'm a, you know, a 4-point Calvinist, a semi-Pelagian view, okay, or a 3-point or something like that. I'll just tell you what my grandson said. His name is Nathan, he's just turned 4. He gets on the phone the other day and he said, "And Grandpa, Papa, I'm not sick. I'm dead in my trespasses and sin." So we got the final answer from Nate. So they teach him deep stuff at their Sunday school. Unfortunately, Toad goes to preschool, so he told his teacher, "The world doesn't like to hear that we're dead in our trespasses. They kind of like to hear I'm either sick or I'm alive and well." And so that's it. You have a sheet here with a chart here, and rather than going over them, the Platonism, for some reason I didn't get in there, but some of the views I'd like to highlight under 4 at the end. And the Council of Chalcedon at 451 really clarified what had already been stated by the Council of Constantinople in 381, that they made a great statement. Christ is one person in two natures. That's a historic statement. One person, two natures. Without confusion, conversion, severance, or division. So that is a historic statement. And so when you say, is Christ one person, the answer is yes, but he has two natures. He's fully God and he's fully man. At the bottom, some conclusions. When persecution ended, doctrinal deviation within became great. It became great controversy. Number 2, doctrinal truth that we take for granted were often hammered out in the heat of strife. I mean, Joel's right. I mean, just heat of strife. They had councils. There's a great need for balance, even in theology. And overset differences of a truth can easily become a heresy. Be careful about that. Be in the center of the right lane. All right? The major debates often centered on Christ. The person of Christ is not simple. How do you explain him to be fully human, fully God, and same in essence with the Father? But you know, I mean, it's not a simple concept. The councils tended to come to the right conclusions, which is an amazing thing. And at least these major ones. The error often started when sincere men, and that might be debatable, but seemed like sincere men, were seeking for truth, or how do I handle truth, and or were trying to protect from error. So many of these guys started right, and were right. By the way, the councils tended to the right conclusions. By the way, Arianism, once the council condemned it, they totally rejected it. Arianism spread like wildfire across the empire. So, and if you study the map, the Mediterranean's here, Constantinople, where they condemned it, it came from down in the south here. And Arianism spread through all of Europe, came back through Spain, and 100 years later came right back to Carthage. And it's, you can condemn, you know, you can sit in a room with 318 guys and condemn something, But if it's popularly impressive, we can't stop it. And it went. And so it was always a problem. There's another sheet of definitions that may help. Let's look at some personalities, by the way. Next week, I'm going to give you those words. Your quiz is those 11 words, and you can write out the definition. Personality, just some names. John Chrysostom, called the Golden Mouth, is one of the most read and frequently quoted of all the early fathers, by the early fathers. He was patriarch of Constantinople in 397. So he was a great preacher. And many of the fathers, they will quote him. Ambrose, he was born in Germany. I want you to see that how the church had really spread. It was in Britain, Germany, it was all over. It wasn't just limited to a few spots, all right? He was a bishop of Milan, Italy. He had tremendous influence on Augustine. He was a great, great preacher. He was a great orator. We'll see that next week in 4b. Jerome is another name. He was fed up with the ornate vestments, the big churches, the worldliness. And so he said, I'm going to go the other way. So he became a monk, went to a monastery in Bethlehem. He actually lived in a cave next to or near the cave that probably Jesus Christ was born in. And he lived there from 386 to his death in 420. What he's famous for is that he translated the Bible into the Latin, and therefore that became the Vulgate. And he did that because he took it all from the original Hebrew and Greek, and he went to the Latin. At that point, you know that the Old Testament had been translated into Greek, so everybody else was translated from Greek to Latin, Greek to Latin. He went back to Hebrew, primarily because he was one of the few men left who knew Hebrew. They had given up on the original language. You remember the Reformation, that was one of the turnarounds. Calvin and Luther, Erasmus said, if we're ever going to study the Bible, we have to go back to the original language. We've got to stop relying upon our translations. They weren't against translations. Translations are great, but if you're really going to study it, you've got to go back to the original languages. So Jerome was pretty famous for that. Augustine is the one you probably know the most about. His parents sent him to Carthage for the best education available. He's a pretty sharp kid, I think. Carthage, of course, was, hey, look at the five major cities in the Christian world at that time. It was Rome and Constantinople, Antioch, Carthage, what was the other one? Alexandria. Two of them were on North Africa. North Africa was the very strong church place, and most heresies came out of North Africa, so they were the scholars. Alexandria was considered the most educated. Carthage was close to that. Libya, you'd be surprised how many of these guys came out of what we call Libya today. Arius was from there. Many of them came out of there. So Libya was a powerhouse of Christianity. Anyway, he was sent to Carthage for the education. He didn't like the Bible, shifted to heathen poets, and especially a form of man, I-C-H-E-I-S-M, all right, which is a mixture of heathenism and Christianity. So he went there. He became a totally vulgar, wicked person, if you read his confessions. His mother, Monica, prayed fervently for his salvation. He was appointed to Milan as professor of public speaking and oratory, rhetoric, from Rome. He'd gone to Rome. They had appointed him as professors there. While he was there, because he was fond of oratory, he went to hear Ambrose. Ambrose was a great preacher. So an orator likes an orator. So he sat there and listened to him. His mom was praying for him. He had been trained as a Christian boy. And all of a sudden, his awe had it coming crashing down on him. He went to a garden one day, and that's the famous quote, tole lege, take up and read. He happened to have in his hands the epistles of Paul. And in that, he turned in his Bible, or he was reading from, somehow he got to, Romans chapter 13, verse 13 and 14, which reads this, let us walk properly, as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in lewdness and lust, not in envy and strife, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lust. And that was like wham, 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 wham. And God brought him out a great conviction, and he said that's when he was converted, and he did change, that's for sure. He was converted in 386, began to defend and expound the scriptures. He fought vehemently against Pelagius. He wrote the books, Confessions, which was his biography, if you would, his transformation. And he also wrote the book entitled The City of God, which was his view of history, which, because of that, he popularized for the first time amillennialism. And pretty much before that, you don't read anything about amillennialism. It's all premillennialism. But now it's becoming popular because he was brilliant. He wrote well. Calvin, Luther, all the rest imbibed of him greatly. He had one other problem, as far as I'm concerned. He had great points, all right? But he had one other problem. He was truly a Platonic dualist. He had read too much of Plato, and he had accepted too much of Plato. So he believed that anything to deal with the flesh was evil. So your hand's evil. Anything is physical is evil. Anything to do with spirit is whatever. Joe?
I thought he was a real big case study on Christianity being the true religion, because he was kind of like a liberal professor of today. He was very not what Christianity would say, and he completely converted.
Yeah.
And it was a very intellectual conversion, too. It wasn't just a like a random thing. It was very intellectual.
Yes, he did. He made a great turnaround. And he had, if you read the Confessions, you see him pour out his heart about his life and what God did. A couple other figures. St. Patrick, missionary from Scotland to Ireland. The Britons, the Celts in Britain had been converted in the 300s, and now in the 400s, they send St. Patrick over to Ireland. He was a great man in many ways. He preached the Bible. He was free from the error of Rome. Many of the things we'll read about later about Rome, he did not imbibe of. He was a man of prayer. As far as I know, even though if you read in Wikipedia and so, he's called St. Patrick. As far as I know, the Catholic Church has never canonized him because they don't accept what he really stood for. He probably was a true believer and a true evangelist and went to Ireland, so as near as I can tell. Leo I is an important figure. According to Schaff, he's the first pope in the proper sense of that word. Remember, nothing just, boom, we start. Okay, everything has transition, and you wake up one day and you have it. Okay? He is the first Roman bishop to assume the title pope in a full sense. He saw himself as a pope. He developed a biblical argument for the supremacy of the Roman bishop. Remember, now we have, is Rome the head, or is Constantinople the head, or is everybody equal? He developed the succession, that great succession theory, back to Peter. Peter was established as the first bishop of Rome by Jesus Christ, the vicar of Rome, and therefore is passed on. So he developed all that. But in many other ways, he was very orthodox. So you might not like Leo I, but I think a lot of other things you like about him. One other name, Columba. I think I gave there as a missionary to Ireland and Scotland in the 500s. And then Gregory the Great, and that's what will be next week. So there are many, many names. Those are just some of them. Some conclusions that you can perhaps read. The emperor exercised a large influence and control of the church and the church on the emperor. Okay, so there is a mixture of church and state, and suddenly they're going to. The Western Church becomes more independent because the power politically is in Constantinople in the East, and so the West, Rome, they become more independent, while the Eastern Church become more enslaved and connected to the state, and they live in the same city and they interact a lot. Okay. By the end of the, by the way, when we study the popes in the medieval time, the next 3 weeks, you'll see how that concept shifted over to what we think of a Roman Catholicism in Europe. But initially that was true more in the East, Constantinople, Turkey, and all that area. Okay. Here's a list from Kuyper, page 44, I think. By the end of the 5th century, so if there's something right, it's because of Kuyper. If there's something wrong, you have to blame Kuyper too. Okay. Here's some things. By the end of the 5th century, by 500 or so, these probably are in existence in some form. Prayer for the dead, a belief in purgatory, a 40-day Lenten season. By the way, Kuyper, interestingly enough, says these are all in existence. All these, I think he words it this way, all these heresies are in existence. So he tells you what he thinks about the whole list. So you might not think they're all heresies, but he does. A belief that the Lord's Supper is a sacrifice, the sacrament, both. Only the priest can administrate the communion. There's a sharp division between clergy and laity. The veneration of martyrs and saints. The adoration of Mary as the Mother of God and the Queen of Heaven. Now you're going to find, hopefully someday I'll have a list of all the decisions by the Pope, by the Roman Catholic Church when it became official. So a lot of these things were kind of practiced maybe for hundreds of years, and then one day the Pope will make a statement that officially Mary is the mother of God or the Queen of Heaven. That might have been practiced for 100 years. So some of these actually became official later on. But it's going on at this time. The burning of tapers and candles in honor of saints. The veneration of relics, pictures, and images and altars. The way the whole concept of images and pictures became one of the dividing points between the West and the East. If you ever go into an Orthodox church versus a Roman Catholic church, you immediately see that vast difference. And if you walk into an Orthodox church, there are images and pictures all around, and if you're godly, you walk up to all of them and you kiss them. And hopefully you follow somebody who doesn't have AIDS, because you're all kissing the same picture, all right? The veneration of the gorgeous vestments for the clergy became more and more ornate, the hats and the colors and the whatever, more and more elaborate ritual, less and less preaching, began the pilgrimages to holy places. You'd somehow, I don't know if you've ever been to pilgrimage places like Israel, if you've ever been there and you see these people come to these, they are on pilgrimage. And there's something meritorious about it. Just to show up in Bethlehem and just walk in that church, you have just earned yourself some friends with God. Monasticism, or monasteries, worldliness, the persecution of heathen and heretics. So the church, which was persecuted, now became the persecutor. Right, that's from Piper. The next list is from Showers and some other places. Again, these are developing. Some of them are here now in some form. Baptismal regeneration. By the way, just because some practice doesn't mean everybody practices it. There were great Christians in this period, right? But these things are present. Amillennialism is popularized and becomes the dominant eschatology view by the end of this period. And it fits perfectly with the Roman Catholic system. The priesthood of, not of believers, but of priests, right? A double standard of conduct between clergy and laity. Bible study is discouraged, especially for the laity. It's not even very popular for the clergy, but for sure the laity is not to read it because you can't understand it anyway. The organized church shifted from, this is important to get, from Catholic, where Catholic means each bishop is equal. If you're the bishop of Milan, the bishop of Rome, whatever, we're all equal. They shifted from that to Roman Catholic, with the bishop of Rome the first among equals. It's interesting when I came from a background where there were no Catholics around us. I remember in I think it was ninth grade when the first Catholic that I ever saw came to school. So we all watched to see what Mary was like, you know. She dressed like the rest of us. It was the first Catholic I ever saw, you know. So we moved to Leroy, our first church, and it's just Catholic. And as you go down the street, you know, you think us Baptists have split. You ought to see the Catholics in Western New York. So they have two Catholic churches across the street, and never the two will meet. You know, they won't talk to each other. They harass each other. One is the RC church. And one is the Catholic Church. And it's just, they are very divided there. The RC, we are RC. They were the Italians, the Catholics were the Germans. And they would have eat together, they wouldn't do anything together, okay? So there's this shift there, from Catholic to Roman Catholic. The bishops of Rome claimed their church was founded by Peter and Paul, and that Peter was his first bishop, that Christ appointed Peter as his vicar, or his representative on earth, and that the bishops of Rome inherited the vicarage, the representation, by apostolic succession. The next date may be debated. In 445, somewhere in there, this is from Showers, so that's where I got the date. The emperor officially recognized the primacy of the Roman bishop. Of course, which emperor? The guy in Constantinople? By this time, the emperor was such a split, even politically, that there was at some point two emperors. That was not uncommon. Licinius and Constantine were co-emperors way back in 313. So there's a conflict going on east and west. By this time, there's a system of seven sacraments. If you've ever studied Roman Catholicism, they have seven to this day. Last rites, marriage, many other things. Christ's birth is now officially observed on December 25 in the west. And what they don't say is in the east, it's still January 6th. And they make it official. Sunday is the official day of rest and worship. So it becomes official. So, what do we learn? Any lessons? Capture.
question.
Yeah.
You said the Crash Course is their standard market. Because I've recently heard like why Christianity picked that day. Is that why? Or like
a lot of people believe that. I'm not sure. I'm 100% convinced of that. But it's a syncretism between paganism and Christianity. It could very well be. Was it really a pagan holiday? Just like Easter. I think Easter is from the Bible, but anyway, there are those who would say our Christian holidays, birth of Christ in particular, came from a pagan background. We don't need to go into that today, but there's many, I can show you many writings on that. Yep. What'd you learn?
Covenant theology.
There you go, all right.
I learned how fast it can spread, I didn't realize what it was.
Yeah. Yeah. And Britain, really fast. Amazingly. You got the Celts. The Celts really is a. When we thought about conversion, it didn't mean everybody was generally born again Christian for the heavens. They became a group of Christians. But it was because they could synchronize. Once you let people mix stuff, they are much more open to, sure, I'll become a Christian as long as I can bury my llama piece in my footing, you know?
True Christian theology.
Yeah. And we're true believers the whole 9 years. Yeah.
Always.
Yeah. Always a remnant. Here's a book called The Trail of Blood. If you haven't read it, I'm not sure I buy all of its statements, but it's a very interesting book. It's very small, little white red paperback. How he just started that. You know, the early church and God has always had his trail of blood. He calls it the trail of blood because. Not because they follow the blood of Christ, but because those who do that all become martyrs, that groups. Okay? So, I think one of the things you'll find, and I've said some of these things, is that once you allow the church to include everybody, you'll probably have church problems in the church. Okay? And that's what happened. And I didn't mean there weren't good people in it. Some of those overreacted and said, hey, there's so much corruption here, I'm leaving, so I'm going to get on an island in the Nile River and sit on a pole. And that's my city, you know? That might be a little bit of an overreaction, but maybe I would have felt the same way, you know? God always has his remnant, which is things. Remember this, the center of the right lane, that's where you should be, not the wrong lane. Whatever's truth, just stay there, hang on, because... If you start looking too far, you worry too much about falling off that side, you probably start to weave over here. Next thing you know, your wheel's going over the other side. Stay in the center of the right lane. Look ahead. Keep going straight. Whatever. Joe?
I learned that I don't think St. Patrick's Day is celebrated very well for in remembrance of him. I don't think you would like that probably, the way that goes down.
Probably not.
I didn't know anything about him before, so...
Yeah. What you will find is, we talked about Augustine and Constantine, it is all in part determined in my heart. He's a true believer, he isn't. Because even Leo the First was orthodox in many things, but he started popery. But his motives, even though Gregory the Great is considered, in some ways, historically the first pope, Leo the First is the one who claimed it. In some way, it may have been somewhat rightly motivated. There's so much error out there, somebody's got to step up and take the head of this thing, you know? We're going to close in prayer. Have a great time. We'll come back. And we'll look at the medieval church. And the rise of the papacy, the next week, the height of it, and we'll have a great time. So.